My name is Willie, and I am an alcoholic. I always carry this sheet of paper with me. And people always think, well, now Willie has all of her notes on it. And sure enough, on this piece of paper I have written, your name is Willie and you're an alcoholic. I haven't found it absolutely spit and fitting necessary to have a drink of alcohol since June the 19th, 1957. It's due to this fellowship, this program, and God's grace. My job up here this afternoon is to think along with you and to give some thought to step two in this beautiful program of ours. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, I will be working from the 12 and 12. Charlie and Joe do such a beautiful job of the big book. Beautiful. And I like to work from the 12 and 12 because that's another one of our textbooks. It takes each step and breaks it down for us. The big book covers every one of our steps, but as Bill explained after he had put the big book out in that first 100, that the steps needed to go into a little bit more detail, so he writes the 12 and 12, or the 12 and 12 is put together. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And you know, just that phrase, came to believe. I was so thrilled when Patsy asked how many new people we had and to see all those hands go up. That is great. New people, when you see that step, look and really see what it says. It didn't say instantly believed that a power greater than myself. It doesn't say that. It says came to believe. You know, I graduated from high school and I graduated from college, but I didn't do it after I finished the first grade. You go through a series, a process of learning before you get diplomas of any kind. And this is a learning process. This way of life is a learning process. It's not something we often say that we wish that for the new people we could just take a magic wand and wave it and say, you have what we want you to have. What we have learned through these years. It would save you so much pain. Because there is pain in growing. It's the only way to grow. Look at any teenager today. There's pain in that growth. And there's pain in growing in this program. But it's sort of a, you know, there's degrees of pain too. If us gals knew exactly, you know, what labor pains were going to be like, we probably wouldn't think of the joys of cuddling the little one so quickly. But we're gaining something through those pains. And you're going to be gaining something through all the various degrees of pain that you go through in coming to believe that this power that's greater than you are can restore you to sanity. Let's take the first part first. The talking about a power that's greater than ourselves. It says, the moment they read step two, most AA newcomers are confronted with a dilemma. And good Lord, we are familiar with dilemmas, aren't we? When we came in here, we were full of dilemma. So we know the meaning of that word. And when we look at that step two, we don't know exactly what to do with it. We don't understand this power greater than ourselves. We don't particularly fall in love immediately with that word sanity because immediately we think of insanity. So we are faced with a dilemma, sometimes a serious one. How often have we heard them cry out, the newcomers, now look what you people have done to us. You've convinced us that we are alcoholics and that our lives are unmanageable. Now, having reduced us to a state of absolutely helplessness, you now declare that none but a higher power can remove our obsession. Some of us won't believe in God, others can't, and still others who do believe that God exists have no faith whatever that he will perform this miracle. Yes, you've got us over a barrel, all right, but where do we go from here? Over on the next page, down towards the middle, we see that, when they're talking with their sponsor, is a very good question indeed of how do we go about handling this. I think I can tell you exactly how to relax, the sponsor says. You won't have to work at it very hard either. Listen, if you will, to these three statements. Three statements. First, Alcoholics Anonymous does not demand that you believe anything. And that's good to remind the newcomer. We don't really demand that you believe anything. All of its 12 steps are but suggestions. And I think that's good for a newcomer to know that. That we are suggesting for them a way of life that we have found that worked. Because every one of our steps have a principle behind it. Step two's principle behind step two is hope. We share our experience and our strength and our hope with the newcomer. So we're not giving him any kind of demand, you be like we are, or you do what we do. We are giving him a subtle suggestion that if you follow a procedure that has been tried and proven, that you may get the same result. It's very likely that you'll get the same results. All of its 12 steps are suggestions. Now, second, to get sober and to stay sober, you don't have to swallow all of step two right now. That's good for the newcomer to know. He doesn't have to take that power and immediately try to fit it someplace into his life. He does not really have to be sold on the insanity or the sanity part of this program. But just, they can take it a little bit at a time. Now, even the people that put this book together, Bill says, looking back, I find that I took it piecemeal myself. You know, we often refer to Bill's blinding, flashing light and the bombs going off and all of this. And here Bill's telling us that he took it piecemeal at a time himself. He got that blinding insight on something greater than he was, but it took him a long time to digest it. You know, we can sample food and we get the taste on our tongue, but that doesn't mean we've digested it yet. That takes a while. Third, all you really need is a truly open mind. Just resign from the debating society and quit bothering yourself with such deep questions as whether it was the hen or the egg that came first. Deep. Again, I say, all you need is the open mind. Dear God, most of us come in here with such closed minds. We've had to close our minds almost to exist. We've had to shut our minds up so very tightly to keep them from thinking. The sign that bothered me the most when I got here was the one that said, think, think, think. Because, see, I lived in a morass of thinking, trying to figure out how I was going to get out of this jam, trying to figure out how I was going to explain this behavior. My mind was anything but open. I didn't see the statement and didn't take it to mean me when it says, you know, just resign from the debating society. Because I was one of these that bellered loud and strong about, you know, my religious beliefs. I'd had a deep, deep religious training. And I thought when they talked about spiritual things and about a power greater than ourselves, that they were demanding some sort of a counterman to my religious training. So I would debate it loud and long with them. There weren't many women around. God bless those men that put up with me and loved me sober. Because we didn't have many women back in those days. But those men sat there and listened to me till one of them got a belly full of it. And he told me, he said, Willie, said, you know, you sort of remind me of the lion that one day he was roaming around in the woods and he found him a bull and he ate it. And when he got through, he was full and he was relaxed and everything, so he let out some loud, loud roars, resounded all over the woods. And a hunter came along and shot him. And the moral of that story is, if you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. He said, now, Willie, if that hurts your feelings, so be it. But I was a member of the debating society on this subject of a power greater than myself. Didn't have the foggiest idea of what they were talking about, but didn't have the sense to know. Later on, a man told me, said, Willie, you know, you don't have to agree with everything that we say. But a nice, pleasant answer is that, well, I don't agree with what you say, but I'll think about it. He said, try it out for a while. See if it doesn't work. You're going to change your mind about a lot of things. That's what an open mind is. It's all right to have an opinion about something, but it's also very nice if you open your mind and listen to somebody else's opinion and think about it. Because once in a while, after you're shut up and quit debating, new thoughts will come in that won't necessarily countermand anything that you've ever believed or that you've ever been taught in your life. But for you new people, remember that the key to this step is an open mind. Because we allow you in Alcoholics Anonymous to go about this one step at a time. And when you get to each one of the steps, it's not one giant leap towards that step. Each one of them are done one step at a time. Over on page 26, your book is different than mine. I've tried to mark mine because it's one of the older ones. I hate that word, older ones. But mine is one of the older ones, but I believe 26, 27. Where it says, this is only one man's opinion based on his own experience, of course. I must assume that that AAs tread innumerable paths in their quest for faith. If you don't care for the one that's been suggested, you'll be sure to discover one that suits if only you look and you listen. Many a man like you have begun to solve the problem by the method of substitution. You can, if you wish, make AA itself your higher power. Here's a very large group of people who have solved their alcohol problem. In this respect, they are certainly a power greater than you, who have not even come close to a solution. Surely you can have faith in them. Even this minimum of faith will be enough. You'll find many members who have crossed the threshold just this way, by holding on to the power of that group, that the feeling that you get when you sit amongst us, that power, hold on to that. If that's all you can hold on to, grab it. Just the power that you feel when a person says, I have been without a drink for so many days, so many weeks. There's hope there. Grab it. If that's all you can hold on to in the beginning, let that be your power. One step at a time. All of them will tell you that once across, their faith broadened and it deepened. Relieved of the alcohol obsession, their lives unaccountably transformed. They came to believe in a higher power, and most of them began to talk of God. So if you've read that step and you think, I can't possibly
take all of that. That's not what we're asking you to do. Take whatever power, based on hope, based on the people that you hear when you go to the meetings, of the dilemma that they faced when they came here, the sure knowledge that they felt that nothing could help them, no earthly power. They had tried everything. It's working for them. It can work for you. All right, it says to consider next the plight of those who once had faith but have lost it. There will be those who have drifted into indifference, those filled with self-sufficiency who have cut themselves off, and those who have become prejudiced against religion, and those who are downright defiant because God has failed to fulfill their demands. Can AA experience tell all of these they may still find a faith that works? Sometime AA comes harder to those who have lost or rejected faith than to those who never had any faith at all. So many times we listen to the people whose early lives were deeply, deeply seated in a religion, in a formal religion where they were members of the church, and they served as altar boys, and they served in as deacons, and they were deeply involved in the church. And then when alcohol began to take their life apart piece by piece by piece, and remember that when you're trying to put your life back together, it didn't fly all apart all at once. It's not going to fly all back together all at once. Sort of like the excitement of putting a jigsaw puzzle together, trying to find the pieces and putting them together one by one by one. But these people that come to us and say, I believed in God at one time, but you know, why has God let all this happen to me? We can sit there and know, but there's no way that we can tell him, now wait a minute, how much of this did you do to yourself? Because most people come to us beaten and bruised. And I think they have to be treated with a little tender love and care in the beginning. I believe in tough love. But sometime in the beginning, the beaten and bruised and humiliated and degraded woman alcoholic that comes to a meeting and looking so hurt and so shamed needs that tender loving care. So I don't try to scream at her, honey, you did it to yourself. God didn't do it to you. Because she's going to learn that. She's going to learn that in time, piece by piece by piece. Since both ways have proved bitterly disappointing, they have concluded that there is no place whatever for them to go. The roadblocks of indifference, fancied self-sufficiency, prejudice, and defiance. Those are the four things that will block you off from that power. Look at them again and take your pencil. Being a school teacher, I mark and underline a lot and circle lots of words. But to me, these words are extremely important. This is what studying the book is all about. I always tell my kids in school, and I've gotten in trouble with a lot of principals for various and sundry reasons, but one of them has been for telling the kids, take your pencil and underline that sentence. Your mama and daddy are helping to pay for these textbooks. We're not going to tear them up. We're just going to underline the important parts. And the next person that uses that textbook is going to know that's important. And see, when I underline in my book, then I know the next time I open that book, those words are going to be underlined. Look at those blocks to getting that higher power into your life. Indifference, fancied self-sufficiency, I can do it on my own. Oh, my. Prejudice and defiance. often prove more solid and formidable to these people than any erected by the unconvinced agnostic or even the militant atheist. Those four traits can actually cause you more harm than if you are an agnostic or an atheist. Religion says the existence of God can be proved. The agnostic says it can't be proved. And the atheist claims proof of the non-existence of God. Obviously, the dilemma, that word again, of the wanderer from faith is that of profound confusion. And don't we as alcoholics do that well? We handle confusion real good because we have been walking around in a state of confusion for a long, long time. He thinks himself lost to the comfort of any conviction at all. He cannot attain to even the small degree the assurance of the believer, the agnostic, or the atheist. Now he is the bewildered one. The one that had faith and lost it. Our 12 and 12 there points out that this is the person that sometime is in a lot more trouble than the agnostic or the atheist. Because once you have something and lose it, if you've never had it to start with, it's like the expression that Dick Gregory uses, you know, about his childhood, said, you know, we weren't poor, we were just broke. I've had kids come to school, you know, and look at them as first graders, and a lot of them are real, you know, extremely poor. And they come from what we call poverty level. But they really don't know that till they get to school. So they don't hurt as deeply as those who have experienced having a lot of things, as we're going through with a lot of people now. Father has lost his job, so the car had to go. And the motorcycle had to go, and many other things that Father was helping to keep up. And there's a lot of bitterness attached to that, more so than the kid that's rocked along and never had all those things to start with. Because, see, that kid can keep on dreaming. They say, someday I'm going to get me a car. Someday I'm going to have me that motor. Someday I'm going to have those skis. But the kid that's had them and had to give them up is bitter. And a lot of our people coming to us will be bitter if at one time they had a deep faith in this power. And then alcohol beat that faith absolutely out of them. Let's be patient with those particular people. And remember that our book tells us that they're having a hard time. Down at the bottom of page 29 in your book, no, it'll be about the middle, but it starts out, the paragraph starts, now we come to another kind of problem. Find it. Now we come to another kind of problem. The intellectually self-sufficient man or woman. To these, many AAs can say, yes, we were like you, far too smart for our own good. We love to have people call us precocious. We used our education to blow ourselves up into prideful balloons, though we were careful to hide this from others. Couldn't take a compliment. Someone said, you did that well. Oh, well, I just... blah, blah. We were very careful not to let anybody think that we would be boastful. But it was there, and it stood as a block. Secretly, we felt we could float above the rest of the folks on our brain power alone. Scientific progress told us there was nothing that man couldn't do. Knowledge was all-powerful. And Joe and Charlie talked about the knowledge where people thought that if they knew enough about alcoholism, if they knew enough about it they would be able to do something about it. I suffered from this malady when I came to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I figured that if I could find out about this thing and find out why at one time I could drink and then I couldn't, then my problem would be solved. I could go back and drink again. And many of our people are coming to us with just exactly that attitude. If we can find out enough about this thing, and they're hearing so much about alcoholism, about the problem of alcoholism, that we're going to have to be extra patient with the new people coming in now, even more so than 10, 15 years ago. You know, everything, every place you turn now, you're reading about us. You turn on the television and they're talking about us. And they say an alcoholic is. Now, did you ever see anything that an alcoholic is? Really, the only thing consistent about an alcoholic is his inconsistency. You take an old drunk, you let him walk by your house every morning at 8 o'clock. Oh, for 8 or 9 years, he's been walking by there. And one morning you're feeling extra benevolent and extra good, and you decide you're going to go out and speak to him. Hell, he won't come. Yet when we read about us and when we listen to the experts talk about us on television, they say an alcoholic is a person, blah, blah, blah. And in all of these years, I have not seen one of us that will fit into a hole in an egg carton. We suffer from a common disease. And from then on, the comparison is gone. You sit in enough meetings, you get to know enough alcoholics, and you'll know that we share basically two things: pain and the loss of control of our lives. Knowledge is not going to get it done. They can study us, they can take us into little pieces and put us under microscopes. And I think this is why they're in a dilemma now, because we won't fit into a pattern. They'll get one fella and they'll tell him that, you know, maybe the reason he's an alcoholic is because he had a real tragic childhood. And the next old drunk that comes along has a beautiful, beautiful childhood. They'll analyze one person as, well, now, if you'd have gone ahead with your education, you would have felt better about yourself. What you need is to feel better about yourself. So go back to school and get your education. And that seems to be the answer. Then here comes the next drunk, and he has a PhD. Then they'll analyze one person as, you know, well, if you had ever gotten to do what you really wanted to do in your life, you wouldn't have drowned yourself in the bottle. And then there's a bimbo like me that comes along and tells them how much from the very moment in 1944 when I ever walked into my first classroom, how I never, ever wanted to make a living any other way besides teaching school. So they don't know what to do with us. I'm beginning to feel a little bit sorry for the experts in trying to make us fit. So finding out about alcoholism, I found, was not the answer. What I needed to know is to find out what alcoholism had done to Willie, what it had robbed me of. I could not go back and lean on the poor, pitiful experiences that I had had growing up. I could not go back and lean on the fact that I did not have an education. I could not go back and lean on an unhappy marriage. I had just about run out of excuses. I was still making them up, because I was still capable of doing that. Any old drunk can do that. But learning about what alcohol had stripped me of in the midst of all my plenty. I did not have, when alcohol came into my life, I did not have bad feelings about Willie. I never had any reason to have bad feelings about Willie. Now, I can go back, and I think our teenagers are in great dilemmas nowadays of all the soul searching that they are required to do, or they think they're required to do, on every hand. Because any teenager can look and see where they are perfectly miserable. It's legitimate. It's almost required to be miserable if you're a teenager. But the nice part of it is, it always has been. That's the nice thing for them to learn. That it's always been misery to grow up. There are great, great dilemmas in growing up. And we can take the very smallest thing, you know, at 15, a very small scenario in our life we can take and build up into a three-act play. Drama and being a teenager goes together. They aren't miserable. They want to die. I was the same way. They're no different than I was. You know, one of the most tragic happenings that, you know, could possibly happen to a young teenage girl is to have a new boy in the little village I'm from of Spring. There weren't many kids in school, and we just had the one school. And every once in a while, a new boy would come in. And Lord, wouldn't you know, that would be the morning that I got up with a pimple right on the end of my nose. I'm talking about misery, depression. This was the end of the world. So I didn't have really any of these excuses when it came down to looking back and saying, this made me drink. This situation in my life or this situation in my life. And that if I can correct all these things that alcohol did to me, this is what I needed to know. How to correct the things that alcohol robbed me of. My self-confidence. The being able to hold up my head. To show me how to get rid of that horrible, horrible guilt. To give me back what alcohol took from me. In trying to find this power greater than myself, I found that it was given to me a piece at a time, as the book promised. You know, there are promises all through this program. This is one of the promises that it gives to you as a newcomer. This power will come. Latch on and hold on to the hope that you see and feel in this room while you're here this weekend. There's a lot of hope here. And with hope, there's a lot of power. If that's all you can latch on to right now, grab it. There's a second part of this step. About the insanity. And goodness gracious, I quarreled with this because I had all these degrees hanging on the wall, and here were a bunch of dummies trying to tell me that, you know, I had to be restored to sanity. I was still teaching school. I was holding my job. My marriage was still together. I was functioning as an Air Force officer's wife. And they were telling me that I needed my sanity restored. I could go along with them on the part about the insane behavior of sure, I did crazy things when I was juiced up. Crazy things. And that's what I thought they were talking about. until I really did get to studying about this program and knowing that that's not the kind of insanity they were talking about. It's the insanity that happened to me between the times I was drunk. The insane feelings that I had, the insane thinking. You know, the insanity of taking the first drink with the idea that this time I'll control it. That's insane. It's just like me telling you that if I walk out there and say, rain, it's going to rain. I had proven to myself over and over and over again that it wasn't going to be any different. How much more beating did I need to take? For the sake of the new people, I'm going to pass the old baseball bat story on that all the old timers have heard many, many times, but see, these new people haven't heard it. And I think it's a beautiful definition of the kind of insanity that we're talking about in this step. We had two doors here, one over here and one over here. And I announced from up here that, you know, you could exit any door you wanted to. And one door, a fella would get up and he'd go out and he'd go right on out and walk out into the sunshine. And at this door over here, the fella that walked out there, there was a man standing there with a baseball bat. And the minute he got out of the door, he rapped him with that bat right upside his head. Now you take all the normal people that felt good about themselves and that really were into this sane thinking. When they kept hearing about the man with the baseball bat, then they would get up and go out that door and walk on out into the sunshine. But all of us in our active states of alcoholism would have kept going out that door and letting that man hit us with that baseball bat. And if we walked out that door and he wasn't there, we'd stay and wait for him to get back. Isn't that what we were doing when we would keep taking that first drink over and over and over again, trying to prove that this time it's going to be different? We don't do that with other things. I am allergic to penicillin. I cannot take penicillin into my body in any form, size, or shape. Now, when I have a serious infection, I don't go in and tell the doctor, hey, let's give old Willie some penicillin. That'll knock the infection real quick. Maybe this time it won't hurt me. I don't do anything like that. Because when I learned about being allergic to penicillin, I learned it because they gave it to me and I quit breathing. And I learned that lesson pretty quick. Willie, don't take any more penicillin. But see, I couldn't learn that lesson as quickly because the deterioration in my thinking had already gotten to a point where I could no longer participate in sane thinking. I was not insane, and neither were you. But I could no longer think sanely. When I would go back again and try to do the same thing that I had just proven to myself I couldn't do. That's insanity. The continued use of alcohol and the reliance upon it for the physical and mental power to meet our daily responsibilities. We don't have to do that anymore. When I had my baby, we were stationed in Montgomery, Alabama. And after I quit drinking, I'm along with a lot of other gals in the program. When I quit drinking, my husband didn't. And he continued right on with drinking. And I continued to be miserable about it. And I decided it was going to be a block in my sobriety and in my happy sobriety. So I bellyached and I moaned and I groaned loud and long about him drinking. Deep in my heart, I still wanted to drink. And deep in my heart, I still figured I could, even though I had been sober for a while. I had been dry for a while. And he came in one afternoon, and he was sitting there. He had mixed himself up a pitcher of martinis, and he was sitting there sipping on those martinis. And I pull out my little Mary Martyr flag, and I start waving that dude. And I'm telling him, how can you do this to me? Those people, because see, you were still those people at that time. Those people in Alcoholics Anonymous tell me that I can't drink and I can't take a pill. And I have been here with this baby all day long and I don't know anything about babies. And I get so tired and I get so nervous. See, I didn't want to meet my daily responsibilities without some help. And I was angry with you because you told me, Willie, leave the pills alone, you don't get into the pills, and you don't take a drink. And I was angry about that, even though I was managing to go on to your dumb meetings. But when my man looked at me after I had said, I get so tired and I get so nervous, and he says, hell, just be nervous. Now you think about that a minute. Just be nervous. That's meeting the daily responsibilities of life. Just be. He's lived to regret those words. Because, see, I have nervous days now. I get up in the morning and I announce that I am going to be nervous all day long. And furthermore, I'm going to make everybody I can nervous around me. Enjoy it, honey. You don't have to poke a pill in your mouth. You don't have to take a drink to meet your daily responsibilities. You don't have to do anything about it. Just shake a lot. Have you heard of anybody ever shaking to death? Remind yourself that, you know, God gave you a nervous system for a reason. So you're nervous once in a while. Big deal. Just shake. And as I say, he has sort of regretted this statement to me. It meant a lot to me at the time. You know, God will talk to you through all kinds of people. All kinds of people. It meant a lot to me that very day. I went through a period, you know, not too long after that, where I'd get so nervous some days I could thread a sewing machine and it was a running. But see, I didn't have to. By that time, you had taught me that I didn't have to do anything about it. I could just be nervous. If I happened to have a bad day and wasn't feeling all the way up, I didn't have to make a big deal out of it and say, you know, I'm depressed. Isn't that the most depressing word you have ever heard in your life? I'm depressed. That's enough to really screw up the whole day if you started out that way. But if you just say, you know, sort of a tan day, that's so much better. We can meet our daily responsibilities without chemical help. We did not think we could at one time in our lives. And maybe you newcomers that are still sitting on your hands think, how am I going to live through all of the things that I know I'm going to have to live through? Maybe divorces. Maybe having children taken away from you. How am I going to do this without any help? Honey, the help that is sitting here in this room are in rooms all over the world. That kind of help you don't have to poke inside of you. You can absorb it. You can learn it. You can feel it. And you can make it a part of your life. Our inability, another cross sign of our lack of sanity when we get here, our inability to be self-critical of the sanity of our behavior over prolonged years of drinking.
You know, to be able to look back on it, our refusal to consider the harm that we have done to ourselves and to other people. How can we quarrel with insanity when we look back at the havoc we wrought in the lives of people that didn't deserve it? My man didn't deserve what I brought on him. The faith that we placed in childish excuses for our drinking and the stupid alibis we thought we were getting away with. Just stop for a minute and think of the childish excuses we used to make for getting drunk. It's sort of like the old drunk that they, you know, jerked out of the burning building, and the police shook him around a little bit and said, "George, we told you not to smoke in bed." He said, "Hell, the bed was on fire when I got in it." Don't we get that good at making excuses? We get real good at it. Probably, I don't know whether you did, but a lot of us folks walk around with answers to questions we haven't even been asked yet. A drunk has to learn how to do that, because Lord only knows what somebody's going to ask us. A very simple, simple question that we don't have an answer to. Like, why did you do what you did last night? We don't have an answer for that, but we come up with one real quick. Because of your attitude. While we let him digest that, then we think up what his attitude was. And we tell him what his attitude was. Or her, whichever may be the case. How about the insanity of the reckless abandon that we displayed in drunken driving? The argument that we drive better drunk than sober, and our resentment towards those who differed from this opinion. Like Charlie and his 55 mile an hour, you know, he wasn't really scolding himself for going over 55. He was mad at that son of a gun that caught him. This is childish, and it's insanity when we get to thinking about it. How we can get behind the wheel of an automobile and take an innocent person's life in our hands over and over and over again. It's insane. The critical physical condition we reach and the continued suffering that we endure from uncontrolled drinking. Good Lord, I don't know why any of us are all in one piece. You know, there's sick folks out there that never abuse their bodies, even a fraction of what we did to our bodies. And the fact that we will continually keep doing this. You know, this is the only body we're issued. We get one to the person. They're giving us spare parts now. But this is really the only complete one that we have. And yet we have taken it in our hands over and over and over again with no regard. I resent even having a headache nowadays. I don't want to feel bad. I don't want to feel bad for 15 minutes. And yet I physically abused my body over and over and over again. It's insane. I didn't just do that when I was drinking. As Charlie and Joe brought out, this is not the insane behavior they're thinking about. The fact that I would not take care of myself in between time. A lot of folks come into AA. A young man was talking to me this morning about coming in and getting busy. So busy, 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 going to meetings and getting into service work and doing this and doing that and all, that he looked up and he couldn't hold his coffee cup steady. And I'm glad you shared that story with me, Rob, because it made me remember to tell my new gals, you know, slow down a little bit, honey, and smell the flowers. We mustn't abuse our bodies now. We're sober. And
other than saying, you know, my husband telling me I'm going to kill myself on that motorcycle, I take pretty good care of myself. And I'm real cautious on my motorcycle. I wear my helmet. I do everything that the law says for me to do. And a lot of things the law doesn't even require. But I want to live now, so I take very good care of my health. The financial risk that we took, the shame and the sorrow and often poverty that we inflict upon our families, the asinine resentment that clogged our minds and our loss of responsibility, getting ourselves drunk to spite or to injure others, the erroneous assumption that we can take it or leave it, our unnecessary squandering of money, contemplated or attempted suicide. Oh, dear God. When I think of the fact that so many of us in this room attempted or contemplated suicide, and we're here, we didn't really keep ourselves from doing that, did we? Because some of us tried terribly hard in one way or the other. If we didn't try with a pistol, and if we didn't try with pills, we tried slowly to drink ourselves to death. That's a sure form of suicide. We see people dying all the time from alcoholic convulsions, from heart attacks brought on by alcoholism. And to think today, on this beautiful day, that we consider ourselves sane when we sat and thought about suicide. No, I no longer quarrel with the insanity that they were talking about. That they wanted to restore me to a sane way of thinking, and that it really had nothing to do with my behavior during the time I was under the influence of alcohol. They were saying to me, Willie, we need to help you go through a psychic change, to undo, to unlearn some of the things, some of the ways of behavior that had become a part of you since you ran head on into alcohol. This is what we mean, insane thinking. To be able to look at a proposition and say, is it true or is it false? When I'm having dilemma in my life, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have taught me to say to myself, is what you're feeling true or is it false? And that cuts down on a lot of dilemma, a lot of dilemma. Because if we face that question very squarely in most of the trials that we're going to run into, is it a real problem or is it an imagined problem? Is what I'm feeling true or is it false? We save ourselves a lot of time. Down, I believe it to be on 33, where 33 begins. It says, few indeed are the practicing alcoholics who have any idea how irrational they are, or seeing their irrationality can face it, bear it to face it. Some will be willing to term themselves problem drinkers, but cannot endure the suggestion that they are in fact mentally ill. They are abetted in this blindness by a world which does not understand the difference between sane drinking and alcoholism. Sanity is defined, as Charlie and them said this morning, as a soundness of mind. Yet no alcoholic, soberly analyzing his destructive behavior, whether the destruction fell on the dining room furniture or on his own moral fiber, can claim soundness of mind for himself. To me, step two is a very, very important step. As I say, it was made plain and clear to me that this was not something that we did all at one time. We can't come to believe in this power immediately, not all of us. We cannot really realize what they're talking about when they're saying they can restore us to sanity. But if we can review some of our insane behavior and insane thinking that we went through when we were not drinking, my sponsor suggested that I make a list, that I keep a running list of all the crazy things that came to my mind when I was still fighting and trying to out-knowledge you people and to learn about what had happened to me. And I made this list. It did me a lot of good. Maybe that suggestion for some of you new people, when you get to thinking real crazy, write it down and 3 days later read it and see how sane it sounds when you are so in, when you feel like that the whole world is falling down on you. Write it down and 3 days later read it back to yourself. You're going to have to read it back because you can't bring it to mind. You'll find that the dilemma you were in, that you thought, there isn't anything going to make me feel better except a drink. Nothing's going to make me feel better. Not those people and not that power they're talking about and none of that. A drink's the only thing that's going to make me feel better. Please take the time. Write it down. Then just hold off 3 days. That drunk will, you know, it'll be waiting. The liquor stores will still be there. They'll still be selling it. Haven't heard anything about prohibition lately. Just put off a drunk for 3 days and then go back and see why you were going to go back to your insane, insane behavior again of taking that drink and thinking it was going to be any different, that the results were going to be any different.